Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Steve Vogel. Steve is a fellow who has started in journalism but is now a full-time writer. He used to be with the Washington Post as a writer, and now he is writing his own books. And the one we're going to be talking about today is very topical because it is about the War of 1812 and all the different things, the burning of the Capitol and whatnot that occurred. The name of his book is Through the Perilous Fight, 6 Weeks That Saved the Nation. Steve Vogel, we'll be right back. So, Steve, how are you this morning?
Good. How are you?
I am fantastic. It is a beautiful day, and I get a chance to talk history, and I love history. You wrote this book. I love the book. This is a fascinating book. Well done, by the way. But I want to start back a little bit. Where are you from originally, Steve?
Well, I kind of grew up all over, mostly in the Washington, D.C. area. I grew up in the town of Alexandria, which is across the Potomac from the Capitol, and in fact, Alexandria plays a part in the story that I write in Through the Perilous Fight. And that was part of my genesis of my interest in the topic.
What part of Alexandria? I used to live there. I used to live in Old Town for a while.
Yeah, I lived in the Old Town area myself. That's where I first worked as a reporter for a couple of the local newspapers in the city. There was actually quite a bit to write about in those days. And earlier, I lived in the Northridge area with my parents.
So how did you get started writing and reporting? My brother was a reporter and then succumbed to the family curse and became a lawyer, but he started off as a reporter, literally doing a little neighborhood newspaper when he was 10 years old, because he loved it. And you know, he was disappointed to have to leave it. But so, how about you?
Well, first, I'm sorry to hear that he left journalism for the law. That's about the only profession you can move to from being a journalist that's lower on the rung.
So. Okay, fine, good. Score one for Vogel.
No offense meant towards you at all, of course.
Of course.
Yeah, it's we are both those professions are not always beloved, probably because they involve asking a lot of impertinent questions. But in my case, I just always loved reading newspapers as a kid, and was also interested in foreign affairs and just international happenings. And so when I graduated from college, needless to say, I looked for a job in newspapers, and my first job at the Alexandria Report Packet was, you know, covering the courts and cops and all that good stuff. And I learned that, you know, lots of times you don't have to go overseas to find the good stories. There's some great stories in your own backyard.
You know, that's absolutely true. I was a local prosecutor for a number of years and then a federal prosecutor. But in that, in those capacities, you see more fascinating characters and events than people can imagine. They think that some of these books are The Lincoln Lawyer. My partners and I watched the movie The Lincoln Lawyer, and it was hysterical because all of the events that occurred in that movie were things that we've gone through, you know, from the lying snitch witness, the motorcycle gangs, the whole kit and caboodle. Life really happens, and in this conjunction between journalism and the law.
Very true. Absolutely. Yeah, it's often where the stories emerge are either in the courthouse records or other testimony that you pick up officially or unofficially around the courthouse or the police stations and just the street corners themselves.
And the other thing I found is everybody at some point, all levels of society converge, the rich, the poor, the minority, the majority, everything, the politician, the business person, the labor guy, they all at some point come to that either as a victim or as a defendant or as a witness or as a juror. So you really see a big, fascinating cross-section of life. And if you're covering the courthouse, you've got to see that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, so. All right. You left the Alexandria. What was it? The packet.
The Port Packet.
Port Packet.
And, worked also for another paper, the Alexandria Journal, and then I decided to check out the stories overseas and worked as a freelancer in Germany. Happened to move over there in September of 1989, which was just about 6 weeks or so before the Berlin Wall came down. So it turned out to be a good time to be over there.
What timing? Did you cover that?
I did. I was only intending to stay for a few months. Really, I'd gone over, if the truth be told, I'd gone over timed the visit to coincide with Oktoberfest and thought I would stick around a couple months just to see what happened. And the next thing you knew, the wall was coming down, and I ended up staying over there for about 5 years.
Were you there when the first breach took place? That is, that first night when we all saw pictures of the people taking hammers and sledgehammers and crowbars to knock it down.
I was sitting in my apartment in Munich, practicing my German by watching Mr. Ed on TV. It had German undertitles underneath it, so it was great. You know, you could see what Ed was saying and see how they translated that into German. It was great. Then they sort of interrupted the broadcast to show this announcement that had been made by the East German government, and my German was good enough to realize that I needed to get on the next plane to Berlin. So did get up there that following morning, and it was quite a raucous scene for many days to come.
I had occasion to go through that area and to see the little parts of the wall that are left, and in near the Brandenburg Gate and Checkpoint Charlie. And I tell you what, even though it's many years, Checkpoint Charlie and the Brandenburg Gate for its symbolism, its existence through the wars, and that horrible but fascinating Berlin Wall, that you're just captured by it. It's a city of great mystery in a way and history.
Yeah, it's a city that definitely resonates with the footsteps of history for sure. I'd been up there actually. I had been there I guess in the late 1970s when the wall, of course, was still up, and made a very powerful impression on me.
Well, so what did you do else after that? You had 5 years in Germany. Was that all that time as a freelancer?
Yeah, I was stringing for a number of publications, but primarily the Washington Post and the Army Times, and you know, ended up covering the first Gulf War and going down to Africa, you know, for Rwanda and Somalia, and the Balkans conflicts. So it was kind of an eventful 5 years or so, and then I came back to take a full-time job with the Washington Post, and was back doing police beat for a while, a midnight graveyard shift, which again was when a lot of the best stories were emerging.
And the circle was not unbroken.
No, right, definitely around. Not. Yeah, it was one continuous revolution, but exciting times.
Well, how long did you work for the Post?
About 20 years.
What, besides the police beat, what other areas did you cover?
Focused mostly on military coverage over, the last 10 or 15 years. Covered both the military as an institution in the Washington area, and covered the 9/11 attack on the Pentagon, covering it more from the standpoint of the building, the people who worked there, and what was going on with the reconstruction of the building. And that was the genesis for the first book I wrote, The Pentagon, which is a history of the building itself, the race to build it during World War II, the people who behind that remarkable project, and then the 9/11 attack and the Phoenix Project, which was the big effort to get the building back restored within a year. So then covered the conflict in Afghanistan and Iraq. So a lot of military coverage, and then in recent years doing a lot of reporting on veterans.
A cousin of mine was in the Pentagon on the other side of the building when the plane hit. Were you there at that time, or did you come quickly to the building?
Yeah, I was not there when the plane hit, but drove up from across the river, and essentially we were brought into the building. Believe it or not, that the Pentagon was burning for several days after the attack, and it never shut down completely. People were still working, and the press room was open that next morning. So it was an interesting situation.
Well, did you in all of the places that you covered, you've ticked off a list of the world's events: Rwanda, Iraq War, Kuwait War, the wall, and now the Pentagon and 9/11. What did that leave you with? What, just forget about for the minute, let's talking about your current book, but what kind of impressions were fixed in your mind about people, about events, about history, as you went through these fascinating steps?
Well, for me, I mean, it was always a reminder of the difference that a few people can make. Even in a situation as horrific as Rwanda, meeting people who stood up, who had the courage to say no to try to stop the genocide, that was always powerful. Even through some of those terrible events, like the attack on the Pentagon, 9/11, some of the most memorable people I ever met in my life were in those days that followed. I think events like that really bring out the best in a lot of people.
I remember seeing a PBS interview with the Canadian general who was in Rwanda at the time of the of this horrible massacre, where 900,000 people were massacred in a planned execution, mass execution. Talk about genocide. And I remember him describing how he tried to go through the United Nations to get help, and nobody responded.
Yeah, Romeo Dallaire. I met him in Rwanda at the time, he was pretty shaken at that point. I mean, he was a remarkable, still is a remarkable person who was doing the best he could in just a terrible situation. But, you know, the frustration, just the haunting realization of this great evil that had taken place in the last couple of months was something that, you know, I think profoundly impacted him and really anybody else who was exposed to it.
Were you there while the massacre was going on?
No, I showed up. Let's see, the massacre started in April of '94, and I got there in July, basically as the forces of Kagame were taking over, and they'd more or less restored some sense of peace and order to the country. And what was going on at that point was this humanitarian crisis, because you had so many refugees who'd been displaced, and they were in places like Goma, where they were being stricken with cholera and other just terrible ailments, and dying at thousands and thousands per day. And what I saw in those days was the U.S. military came in to set up water filtration plants and really started saving lives almost immediately. That was trying to bring some effort to end what had been a catastrophe on so many levels.
Well, on that somber note, I'm going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a minute. This is John Smetanka. The name of our program is With Respect. We're talking to Steve Vogel, a reporter, both freelance, big newspapers, small newspapers, on his own, and the author of a book we're going to be talking about now called Through the Perilous Fight, about the War of 1812. And I think it has a lot to talk about, which it applies to perhaps modern life as well. We'll be right back. Back on With Respect with Steve Vogel, the author of Through the Perilous Fight, about the War of 1812 and a particular part of it that as he puts as his subtitle, there are 6 weeks that saved the nation. And on the cover of this book, you have the picture of the burning of the White House. And we'll see that anomaly, see how the words and the pictures tie together in just a minute. But anyway, Steve, when we got going, you were talking about your first book was on the Pentagon, on the history. But this is different. This book on the War of 1812 and the attack on Washington. It's different, qualitatively different. Tell me, how did you get into this?
Well, you know, it goes back to really growing up in the Washington area, in Alexandria. Here we're in this area really immersed in Civil War history, and not unsurprisingly, given what happened here. But in Alexandria, you couldn't walk around a corner without running into a plaque or a statue related to the Civil War. And yet, you saw very little, almost nothing, in fact, about the War of 1812, where just 50 years earlier, Alexandria had been captured by the British. You know, across the river, the White House and the Capitol had been burned. It was remarkable, really, how little people growing up in this area, or like the rest of the country, knew about what had happened in the War of 1812, and in particular when the British attacked Washington. And it was really just a sense of curiosity, as much as anything, in interest in local history that brought me to this project.
Well, now, why don't you set the stage for us? The framework of this was that in 1812 and leading up to it, we had a revolution in which we broke away from the mother country, Britain. We're struggling to get our country going. Went through Articles of Confederation, and then we got a constitution in 1789, and all kinds of events were going on around the world at the same time, which eventually brought us into this second war of independence, some people call it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this war, coming a generation after the Revolution, we really have to look at the War of 1812 almost as an offshoot of this Titanic War that had been waged in Europe for the previous 20 years. You know, the great wars between Great Britain and France, and begun in 1793 when revolutionary France declared war on Great Britain and, you know, the monarchies of Europe, and then it morphed essentially into this conflict with the rise of Napoleon, and Napoleon conquering most of the continent of Europe by 1812. And the British were really involved in what they saw as a fight for civilization, not just the survival of Great Britain. Napoleon was this threat that the British more or less felt they were fighting on behalf of the world, and they had adopted a "you're either with us or against us" attitude, not unlike the United States after 9/11. And to that end, they didn't hesitate to trample on American sovereignty, to stop American ships at sea, and check the nationalities of all the crew members. Anybody they suspected to be of British origin, they would take and put to work on Royal Navy ships. They were also blocking American trade with Europe. And, of course, Great Britain was still in North America. What today is Canada was then several colonies making up British North America. And there was a lot of trouble brewing on the frontiers between the two nations. So this war, or this disagreement between these two nations, had been brewing for quite some time. And by 1812, James Madison, as president, had concluded that were the United States to continue to allow this to go on, that the United States may have won its freedom a generation earlier, but it hadn't truly won its independence. Mm-hmm. And this leads eventually to Congress declaring war.
But now the Congress, and just as the people at that time, were not unanimous in having negative feelings to Britain or negative feelings to France. In fact, it was pretty mixed, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was almost we almost could have gone to war with France as easily as Great Britain. I mean, there was a lot of tension with Napoleon's government as well. But for Madison, who was of course a disciple of Jefferson, Great Britain was the real enemy, and but the decision to go to war was not by any means universally applauded in the country. It was the nation was more split on going to war against Great Britain than in any conflict, including, say, Vietnam or Iraq. It really tore the country apart.
One of the things that you, as a newspaperman, I'm sure would hone in on is to use newspapers of the day as a way of gauging the temper of the people, the temper of the debate on issues. In my recollection of many areas, many times, I just recently read a trilogy on the run-up to the Second World War, and I looked at the language that was used by the varying parties. It was brutal. These folks who were all Americans, theoretically, really threw bombs at each other.
Yeah. Words like treason and traitor were tossed around. Makes the stuff you hear on the cable news look like nothing by comparison.
That's right.
And in fact, Francis Scott Key, the man we associate with this most patriotic of all American songs, he was a passionate opponent of the war. And he laments to one of his friends, John Randolph, the congressman from Virginia, that the state of our society is radically vicious. Just the venom that was poured out on both sides of this war. And in fact, there are riots in Baltimore where a newspaper that had spoken out against the war is attacked by a mob of pro-war mob, and people inside are dragged out and beaten, in some cases, fatally. So it was a very ugly time.
Well, in fact, also, was it not true that New England, the states of New England, talked about seceding from the Union because they had good relations with Britain?
Yes. I mean, there was a concern about further disrupting the trade, cross-Atlantic trade that they depended upon. So New England was not at all supportive of the war, and there was talk of secession that sort of built up steam as the war went on. And we should always remember that the War of 1812 is a spectacularly poorly named war because it goes on for nearly 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1814, which is the time period that I focus upon, that talk of secession in New England is building up some force.
Well, one last point and a question I have before we get to talk about the players and what happened in that 6 weeks is when the war started and the run-up to that war, and even during it, were we ready as to fight a war? Did we have an army, a navy, and there was a match for the British?
We were in remarkably poor shape to fight a war with anyone, much less one of the most powerful nations on earth. We had a tiny military, a small, poorly equipped, poorly trained army, and a tiny navy, some six ships capable of going to sea, taking on the Royal Navy, which had 1,000 ships, really one of the most powerful forces on Earth. So it was a huge gamble to declare a war. But the concept was that Madison and some of the war hawks in favor of war, like Henry Clay of Kentucky, they were arguing that Great Britain was so tied up with this war with Napoleon that they couldn't muster any force to defend North America. And the idea was that we would declare war and Great Britain would simply agree to negotiate some sort of settlement. But that's not what happens.
Well, and not only that, we were not so lily-white, as one would say, in how we started. As I recall, didn't we try to invade Canada as a part of this?
Oh, yeah, multiple times, and it does not go well at all. The whole idea behind that was Madison wanted bargaining chips, something to he could take to Great Britain and get them to pay attention to American grievances. And the idea is if we could take some territory in Canada, we could use that. And then there are others, such as Henry Clay, who were interested in simply keeping that territory. But in any event, it was all moot because our many attempts to attack Canada all end in ultimately in abject failure. And this basic part of American strategy is not going too well.
All right, tell us, who are the parties? Who are the players, the people? Because you talked about people being and events being woven together. So who are the main players on both sides?
Well, on the American side, of course, we're talking about President Madison, and then some of his most important members of his cabinet, including James Monroe, another future president who was serving as Secretary of State, and John Armstrong, his Secretary of War. On the British side, we have one of the Royal Navy admirals, George Cockburn, who shows up in 1813 with a Royal Navy squadron and begins really a campaign of terror in the Chesapeake. He is the real instigator in what would ultimately lead to the capture of Washington.
Well, when you use the word terror, I think you use it advisedly, because he didn't just look for armies to fight. He was going after something much more basic than that, civilians.
Yeah, I mean, he was basically fighting a form of total warfare that we would see 50 years later with William Tecumseh Sherman in his March to the Sea. Basically, Cockburn's idea was that he would bring the pain of war to the civilian population in order to undercut support for the war. And he, viewed the Chesapeake region, as being home to the seat of the government. It was also really the economic and political heartland of America at that time. And Cockburn's thought was that, if we can turn the population here against the war, the government will have no choice but to either capitulate or make peace on British terms.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take another break right now. We're talking to Steve Vogel, who's the author of the book on the War of 1812 called Through the Perilous Fight, about 6 weeks that we're now going to be leading into and talking about the phenomenal events that occurred. Steve is our guest today. This is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect. This is John Smetanka. We're talking to Steve Vogel, the author of Through the Perilous Fight, about the War of 1812, and that part which deals with very famous things that we still remember about our society and our history. Steve, we now have got some of the players started. You've got Cockburn, who's been terrorizing and been bombarding and burning homes and villages all up and down the Chesapeake Bay area. And then you've got, on the other side, you've got Madison, James Madison, the president, and you've got Armstrong, his Secretary of War, who wasn't really a very effective guy or helpful guy, as I read in your book. But then you have other people. You've mentioned Francis Scott Key. But let's start. All right. What does Cockburn want to do, and what does he do in that? And when is this taking place? This is the summer of 1814?
Right. Well, he shows up initially in the spring of 1813 with the squadron. And there was a British historian who happened to be in America at that time, and he was being held in detention in Philadelphia, and he would later write that until Cockburn shows up, most residents of the Chesapeake would have only known by hearsay that there was a war going on. And Cockburn goes to work changing that very quickly. And Cockburn is pretty much astonished at the lack of resistance he's finding in the country there. And part of the reason was all of our armed forces were up on the Canadian frontier. So the defense of the heartland had fallen to local militias, and these militia were pretty poorly trained, not well equipped, and also quite fearful of leaving their homes, because if they did, it was entirely possible that British raiders would attack their homes and burn them. Any house that where the master of the home was not present was deemed to be abandoned, and the owner assumed to have joined the militia. So it was very effective in discouraging the militia from gathering and fighting the British in any real force.
So how did this attack take place? When did they decide to do this attack on Washington?
Well, Coburn saw opportunities for this early on. And in fact, you know, within a couple of weeks of arriving in the Chesapeake, he's writing letters to his superiors saying that, you know, just with just a very little force, the capital of the United States could be ours. What happens, the real critical turning point, is it comes a year later in the spring of 1814 when Napoleon abdicates in Europe, and all of a sudden Great Britain is in a commanding position to put an end to this festering war in North America. And Coburn gets his wish in the form of some 4,000 British troops who are now freed up in Europe and are put on ships and sailed to the Chesapeake Bay to more or less provide an invasion force. And the British are sending these troops over primarily to serve as a diversion, you know, to create a diversion on the East Coast to relieve pressure on what's going on up in Canada. But Coburn goes to work trying to persuade his superiors to using these troops to actually try to capture the capital.
And he does. That is, he does convince his superiors, and he brings along with him the army that he had gotten, and they march on the capital.
That's right, yeah. He shows the reinforcements, and General Ross, who's come in command of those troops, that there's very little effective resistance in the region. And he's able to convince Ross to execute a landing in Maryland, up along the Patuxent River. The rivers, it helps to have a vision of the geography of the region, but you know, the Chesapeake Bay is really serving as a highway into this heartland, this 200-mile length of the bay, together with numerous rivers that are feeding into it. And the Royal Navy converts the bay into a British lake and gives them access to all sorts of points pretty far inland. So you have rivers like the Potomac and the Patuxent rivers providing access toward Washington, and the British very cleverly launch a three-pronged attack, with one force going up the Potomac River, the main force with the army going up the Patuxent River, and so, then some more ships heading up the bay. And Coburn's theory is that this will utterly confuse the Americans and you know, provide the British with the chance to attack the capital before the Americans really know what's going on.
And they, in fact, did. And part of the story, since this is history, I don't have to, I'm not talking about spoilers here, is they actually beat the bejesus out of what few troops and militia and leaders try to stop them, and they end up in the Capitol.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, it takes about 5 days for the British to march from Benedict, where they land, to just the outskirts of the Capitol, and they've met very little resistance along the way. And on August 24th, the British make a move towards Bladensburg, which is on the northeast border of Washington, the Maryland district borderline. And there they defeat sort of a hastily cobbled together American force that was poorly led and poorly equipped, and these are some very veteran British troops. Some of them had fought with Wellington, you know, for many years through Spain and Portugal and France, and they weren't really deterred by this ill-trained militia. But there is some serious fighting nonetheless, in the form of some of the U.S. Marines and flotilla men under the command of Joshua Barney that put up quite a brave stand at the district line there. But it's not enough to stop the British. And so they do enter Washington on the night of August 24th, 1814, and the capital is theirs.
And they burn it. They burn part of it. And everybody's running around.
Yeah, the American militia is pretty much scattered at this point. Madison and his government have fled. Madison actually comes out to view the battle, but has to flee ahead of the British, and sends word ahead to his wife Dolly to vacate the house. And he spends the next 3 days essentially as a refugee. There's no Air Force One to whisk him away. Very precarious moment for in American history. And the British enter Washington that night of August 24th and get to work quickly on burning the Capitol, the White House, and really almost every vestige of federal power.
Now, we haven't talked about Dolly Madison, but some famous stories about her I think that are interesting, and you may be able to shed some light on the truth of it. First of all, when the British troops came into the White House, they found a banquet set out. And what was all that about?
Well, Dolly Madison was a famous hostess, and it was quite common for her just to have a table set for whoever was in town. And Washington, of course, was pretty abuzz at that time with a lot of military officers and others. So it was sort of the standard hospitality of the day for her to have dinner ready for whoever might be showing up. And it turns out it was the British who showed up. And they did get to help themselves to a very nice meal along with some fine wine in crystal glasses.
Well, and not only that, but as I recall, there was a book that was taken by one of the generals or one of the admirals that came back to us at some point.
Yeah, Admiral Coburn, when they're walking through the Capitol right before setting it afire, comes across a book that is marked as belonging to the president. And it was essentially a ledger book that kept track of the actions of Congress. And he took that as a souvenir and, ends up taking it back to Bermuda with him, gives it to his brother. And many years later, during World War II, it's returned to the United States government.
Now, one last vignette about Dolly. As the troops were coming in, wasn't there a painting there that was very well known?
Yes. The Gilbert Stuart portrait of George Washington, life size. It had been hanging in the White House for several years at that point, and in order to become something of an icon that anybody who came to Washington would go see. And Dolly recognized its meaning to the country and gives instructions to the servants to take down the portrait, not to leave without it. She leaves without it, but she told the servants not to. So she sometimes perhaps is given a little bit more credit for saving the portrait than she deserves, but it was, in fact, her idea that it be preserved.
Do as I say and don't do as I do.
Right.
Now, total chaos reigns in the District of Columbia and this is not during a congressional session. That provides another show sometime. But total chaos. Everybody's running everywhere. They can't find one another. Madison and his wife can't find each other. But the British decide that they're going to go north because they've got this interesting place called Baltimore. What? Tell us about that.
Well, Baltimore was really one of the most important cities in the United States at this point. Third largest city in the country, very important commercial port. It's also a haven for many privateers, which were essentially privately owned ships that were armed and attacking British commerce. So the British had a real grudge against Baltimore, and were very much interested in burning it, taking a very healthy ransom in exchange for not burning it. And this is, something that they, with Washington taken down, the British are hoping that taking Baltimore would really sort of build up this momentum that could force a quick end to the war. So it was a very natural target.
Give us the physical layout of Baltimore. When they start to make their move up the Chesapeake, what do they have to face?
Well, the British have pretty much clear sailing in the Chesapeake to get up to the Patapsco River, which leads into the Baltimore Harbor. But sailing into the Patapsco, as with many of these rivers, there are a lot of shoals they have to be concerned about. So they can't just readily sail in and attack the city. They land their invasion troops in North Point, basically a peninsula that's leading into the city. And then they're going to move some bombardment ships closer to the city to be in a position to attack Fort McHenry. And Fort McHenry stands at Whetstone Point, which guards the mouth of the harbor. Essentially, there's no way to get into the harbor without getting past Fort McHenry. It's at a very critical position. This is where the turning point of the battle would be.
Now, enter Francis Scott Key, and what we're going to be talking about at the this final part, the flag. What about Francis Scott Key? Where was he, and why was he where he was?
Well, Key was everywhere in this story. It's one of the fascinating things to me. We sometimes think of Francis Scott Key being beamed down from outer space and somehow ends up witnessing the bombardment of Fort McHenry and writes a song. But he figures large in this story for me, both in his opposition to the war and then in his involvement. Despite his opposition, he volunteers for the militia defending Washington when the city's attacked. He feels quite differently when his own country is under attack versus being the aggressor. And he's there at Bladensburg. He's part of the debacle there and flees back to the city. And the British, on their way out of Washington, they'd only held the city for 24 hours, and partly that's a function of how small their force was. 4,000 men is not a huge army, and they feared that the Americans, despite the incompetence they'd shown so far, might be able to launch a counterattack, and they needed to get back to their ships. But on the way back to their ships, they had taken an American doctor prisoner. Felt that he had violated certain truce agreements that they had. And Key, who was an attorney, a good one, and also a friend of the families of Dr. William Beans, the doctor who'd been taken, is sent with the blessing of the Madison administration on a mission to try to gain freedom for Dr. Beans. And he has sailed out with an American agent aboard a sloop into the Chesapeake Bay and locates the British fleet. And just as they rendezvous with the fleet, the British have decided somewhat belatedly to launch this attack on Baltimore. So the British agreed to free the doctor, but the bad news is that none of the Americans are free to leave yet because the British are on their way to attack Baltimore, and now Key and the others know too much. So they are detained and held as the British launch this attack on Baltimore. And so Key is then in this prime position as the British launch their bombardment to view what's happening and to, you know, hear the British officers as they're talking about their hopes of really torching this city. They held a very healthy dislike for Baltimore. So Key's very distraught by this. He had kind of expected the British to be more gentlemanly about the whole thing, and he's disillusioned.
Well, we now know the story from our history books, but often history books don't tell the whole story. And we're coming to the end of our show, but I really would like you to describe, what did he see? What did he do? When did this famous poem, which turned into the national anthem, get played or get written?
Well, Key is there with the bombardment squadron, and he knows the British intentions, and he's watching this ferocious bombardment. And the British, over the course of 24 hours, would launch some 1,800 bombs. These are big 200-pound mortars packed with explosives, plus some 800 rockets at the fort. So quite an enormous fuselage is being launched at the fort. And he's for some extent, though, he's relieved that the bombardment is continuing, because that's an indication that the fort is not surrendered. But then once night falls, he can't see the American flag flying over the fort anymore. He spotted it at twilight, but now that it's dark, he can't see it. But the British bombardment continues, and in fact builds up in intensity after midnight. And this, again, despite how frightening it was somewhat encouraging. But then before dawn, the guns went silent, and the ships cut off the fire. And Key, along with the other Americans, are quite concerned. They fear that this means that the fort has surrendered, and with it, Baltimore, and quite likely, quite possibly, in their minds, the United States. The future of the country was at stake. And when Key, when we sing that first verse that Key writes, we always have to remember that there's a question mark at the end of that verse, because Key doesn't know when he's watching this whether the Baltimore or the Republic is going to survive. And at dawn, when he's able to spot the American flag still flying and realizes that the British are breaking off their attack, his relief is pretty enormous. And the song that he begins writing at that point was really more of a hymn of thanks, of gratitude, than anything else. But it really it's published in newspapers almost immediately after Key is released. And very quickly, it spreads up and down the East Coast, and it creates this real visceral reaction in the country. And this is, of course, an era before photography. So there's he's painted this image of the flag still flying over this fort. It was kind of like what, you know, later generations of Americans would see, that, you know, the flag being raised over Iwo Jima by the Marines, or the flags being raised at the World Trade Center or the Pentagon after the 9/11 attacks. It really struck this chord with the American public, and, you know, is instantly, very quickly becomes a very popular around the nation.
And it is put to music. And one of the old, and I hear this from my British friends, oh, your national anthem is just an old drinking song from the bars and the pubs in Britain. That's not exactly what it was it?
Well, no. And, you know, Key was writing a song from the start. You know, there's kind of this myth that it was later, it was a poem later set to music. But this this tune that he's using was To Anacreon in Heaven. And it was a very, very well-known tune. It was originally written by an Englishman about 50 years earlier. In fact, it was written more like 40 years earlier, actually, and it was written for an English gentleman's club. It was the sort of song that they would sing at the end of a dinner. So it's a drinking song in sort of a broad sense, in that the men who were singing it were probably had been drinking. But yeah, it is by 1814 when Key writes the words that would become the national anthem. It was the most well-known tune in America already. It was kind of like, you know, the way Yankee Doodle is endlessly parodied by, you know, many generations of Americans. There had been many parodies of this tune, so it was very well-known. And when it's reprinted in newspapers, and there's usually a little line that says, to be sung to the tune of To Anacreon in Heaven. So everybody knew instantly what how they were supposed to sing this song.
A remarkable story. Remarkable story. And you tell it well, not only here, but in your book, it's with even greater detail. We could talk also about the flag itself that we call Old Glory, which was what was shot at. Or it was in the fort that was shot at, and it was what he saw, or at least a flag was seen as the dawn came and they saw and the bombardment stopped. I wish I could go on forever with this because there are so many interesting stories and people that you've highlighted in this book. In the last words about this, you talk about how this 6-week period made America, and it finished the independence that we had started in 1776. Is that, am I accurate?
Well, what I would say, what I write in the book is that the outcome of this war, which we had seemed to be on the verge of losing after the capture of Washington, this remarkable turnaround that takes place both at Baltimore and then simultaneously at in upstate New York, British forces defeated at Plattsburgh and Lake Champlain. This reverses the momentum towards a British victory, and it allows the United States to extricate itself from this conflict in far better position than anybody could have imagined just a couple of months earlier. And the circumstances with these victories allows or more or less creates a new sense of union that hadn't existed previously in the United States. The states had been more of a collection of states than a union, and this changes after the war. And the United States also emerges with a new sovereignty, more respected in Europe than had been the case previously. The war more or less sets the future course of North America for American westward expansion, and it also makes clear that we were not going to be expanding north into Canada, that this remains British territory for some time before becoming an independent nation. So it really set the course for the future of North America.
Steve, this is a fascinating conversation. I'm glad we had a chance to do this. Your book is excellent. I strongly recommend it to people. If you don't even have to like history to find the delight in this book, the human interests, the events, and whatnot. We've been talking to Steve Vogel, who is the author of Through the Perilous Fight, 6 Weeks That Saved the Nation. Steve, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, John. Enjoyed it.
The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And remember, until next time, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.